The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program. The information provided is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. Always seek the advice of your personal physician or other qualified healthcare professional before changing your healthcare treatment, diet, or lifestyle.
Hello and welcome to the Ocean Mist Power Hour. I'm not going to go through my whole good morning, good day, good night thing that I usually do because, I'm getting a little burned out on that. So hello, I'm so glad you're here. My name is Misty Young. I am your host on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. We are broadcasting out of Brookings Harbor, Oregon, as I call it, the gateway of the Great Pacific Northwest. This is about as far west as you can get in the continental U.S. It is the home of daffodils in December, flowers all year round, and the nicest people you will ever meet. Where the mountains and the old-growth redwoods meet the sea, Brookings and Harbor is home to me. Now, before we get started today, I'd like to say thank you to the entire KCIW sound engineering and production crew. These folks are amazing. They make this broadcast sound good. They get it out there into the World Wide Web and right here on the broadcast on 100.7. And I'm very thankful for them. And I'm thankful for you, our listeners. Thanks for being part of this train. You know, sometimes this train is a rant, sometimes it's a great interview, sometimes it's a discussion about climate or shoe banks or organic foods, and sometimes, like today, it's about nutrition. Now, today I'm going to talk about health. As you know, I'm not a doctor, I'm a nutrition nerd. I do hold a certificate from a nutritional therapist certificate from the Health Sciences Academy. And I have a plant-based nutrition certificate from the E. Cornell T. Colin Campbell Center for Nutrition Studies. Now, one of my favorite people in the whole wide world is Dr. Michael Greger. Dr. Greger runs a nutrition website called nutritionfacts.org. Now, I have kind of heard through the grapevine that there are people that are sort of casting doubt upon whether or not Dr. Greger's grandmother, Frances Greger, could actually be wheeled in a wheelchair to Nathan Pritikin's facility with such bad heart disease that she couldn't walk without pain, she couldn't climb stairs, and that just a few days later, 10 days later, she was walking 10 miles. So for those of you who doubt that, do a little homework. If you don't like that I'm talking about that, find out some information about it and bring it back to me and let's talk about it or share it with me. I'm telling you what Dr. Greger says. Dr. Greger says his grandmother went into that facility on the standard American diet after years and years of heart surgeries and heart conditions to be sent home to die. Literally, she was sent home to die and she heard of Nathan Pritikin. And Nathan Pritikin said, get rid of the standard American diet. Now today, I'm going to change the word standard American diet and I'm going to introduce a new term to you today. So hang on for a minute for that because the standard American diet, frankly, is sad. Sad. S-A-D. Standard American diet. It's sad. So here's Frances Greger eating the sad diet her whole entire life, goes off to see Nathan Pritikin. Boom, he gets her off the sad diet. He gets her into something that is healthful and life-promoting and gives her energy and gives her strength and vitality and youth and vigor. And bam, she's out of that wheelchair and walking. So for those of you that are doubters, that's all I have to say. There, I just said it. I really did. You know what? Somebody asked me today, they're like, so what do you do on your radio show? And I said, I rant mostly about nutrition. And I say things on the radio that I would never in 100 years say face to face to people. So those things are true. I just said those things. They are true. I probably am not going to speak to you in person quite so vociferously. But because it is me in a studio with, you know, just a couple lights around and my computer screen and my incredibly talented, wonderful sound engineer and, just a microphone, I'm going to say what I say. And it's going to be a little ranty. And it might be a little bit edgy. I guarantee you it's going to be a little bit edgy. In fact, it's always going to be a lot of bit edgy. And the reason is because I'm passionate about this topic. And the other reason is that I'm going to do it and be edgy in the radio studio is because I really don't want to engage with you in some kind of debate. I don't want to debate with you. I just want to deliver the facts to you, the medical science. I don't want to get into, well, don't you think that plants feel pain? Like, come on. Come on. Did a carrot ever run from your fork? Did a tomato shriek back when you went to pick it? Do cows do those things if you come at them? They do. Pigs, they do. Lambs, they do. Ducks, rabbits, you know, any other animal that people eat, they don't want to die. They shirk, they shriek, they run. Tomatoes, not so much. Carrots, not so much. Collard greens, I've never seen a collard green run. Wow. So yeah, if we talk in person, it's going to be calm. It's going to be easy. You're going to say, this is not the same person as on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. And you're right, because this is where I get to do my thing and just do it without, you know, people having to ask me if plants feel pain. So Dr. Greger, my buddy at nutritionfacts.org. And here's the other thing. I'm always and only going to share science with you. I'm not going to share opinion unless it's my own, because, you know, sometimes I like to tell you how I feel about stuff. In fact, I always do. But I'm not going to share anything with you that isn't scientifically based. That's not what I learned in the nutritional therapist training or in the T. Colin Campbell eCornell program. I didn't learn anything about opinions. I only learned about medical science and nutrition science. And with Dr. Greger at nutritionfacts.org, it's all about evidence-based nutrition. So I'm not just giving you some theory or some idea. I'm giving you the evidence-based nutrition information. Listen to this. This is crazy. Dr. Greger asks this question: how could there be such a disconnect between the science and medical practice? This is amazing. He says most deaths in the United States are preventable and related to nutrition. According to the most rigorous analysis of risk factors ever published, the Global Burden of Disease Study, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, our diet is both the number one cause of death and the number one cause of disability in the United States, having bumped smoking tobacco down to number two. Smoking now kills about 500,000 Americans every year, whereas our diet kills thousands more. If most death and disability is preventable and related to nutrition, then certainly nutrition is the number one subject taught in medical school and the number one topic your doctor talks with you about, right? Yeah, I don't think so. How can there be such a disconnect between the science and the practice of medicine? Well, let's do a thought experiment, Dr. Greger says. God, I love Dr. Greger. I so appreciate this guy's passion. You know, going back to Francis, his grandmother, he watched his grandmother be sent home to die, and he said, I'm going to do something in thanks for the 31 extra years my grandmother lived because she changed her diet. And he went into medicine as a tribute, a loving tribute to his grandmother. So let's take this thought experiment. Imagine you're a smoker in the 1950s. The average per capita cigarette consumption was about 4,000 cigarettes a year. Think about that. Wow, 4,000 cigarettes a year. In the 1950s, the average American smoked half a pack a day. Wow. When I was a kid in the 60s, my mom smoked. Everyone smoked. Literally everyone smoked. On TV, everyone was smoking. The doctors walked into hospital rooms with cigarettes on their hands. I mean, it was crazy. Dr. Greger says that in his video, how smoking in 1959 is like eating in 2019, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, shows a series of 1950s tobacco ads featuring media stars, famous athletes, and even Santa Claus telling you to smoke. The message was clear. If you wanted to keep fit and stay slender, you made sure to smoke. So magazine ads also encouraged you to eat hot dogs to keep yourself trim, as well as lots of sugar to stay both slim and trim. And one ad even claimed that sugar was less fattening than apples. Apples. The one internal tobacco industry memo stated, quote, apples connote goodness and freshness, and we see many possibilities for our youth-oriented cigarette with this flavor. Oh my God. They wanted to make apple-flavored cigarettes for kids. Talk about shameless. In fact, I remember I used to use those little candy cigarettes. I don't even know if you can buy those anymore, but when I was a kid, you could buy candy cigarettes for a nickel a pack. There were 10 or 20 of them in there. It looked like a little pack of cigarettes. It literally did. They were little white candy sticks with a red tip. That was the flame on that red tip. And of course, every kid did what you would imagine. You put the cigarette between your two fingers, you brought it up to your lips, you pretend to smoke on it, and then you chewed off a little bite. And then you do that over and over. Did you do that when you were a kid? If you're my age, you probably did. I'm 57. Well, you probably, you know, spent some time with some candy cigarettes too. Those were crazy. But as those 1950s ads tell us, in addition to staying fit, staying slender, and guarding against throat scratch for digestion's sake, you could smoke. This is a great quote. No curative power is claimed for Philip Morris, read one ad, but an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So heeding that advice, it's better to be safe than sorry, so you better smoke. These are actual ads, guys. Like, these actually came out of magazines and newspapers, and gee, I could still remember seeing the Marlboro Man on his horse with the oak trees in the background on billboards. So like eating is today, or has always been, smoking was a family affair. Marlboro ads featured babies with little comment bubbles saying things like, "Gee, mommy, you sure enjoy your Marlboro." Or how about this one? "You're darn tootin', my dad smokes Marlboro. He knows a good thing." And here's another. "Just one question, mom. Can you afford not to smoke Marlboro?" In another ad from the 1950s featuring a stereotypically nuclear family, the dad is given cartons of cigarettes from his doting children. One boy and one girl, of course, and even the dog has a carton of cigarettes as his doting wife looks on. Wow. Here's a great tagline. "Blow in her face and she'll follow you anywhere," was one tobacco company's tagline, and "No woman ever says no to Winchester," was another. After all, cigarettes are so round, so firm, so fully packed. After all, John Wayne smoked them until he got lung cancer and died. Well, there's a debate whether it was lung cancer or stomach cancer. Either way, it was a horrible lifestyle that led to his unfortunate demise. Back then, even the Flintstones were smoking, and so were the doctors. This is not to say there wasn't controversy within the medical profession. Yes, some ads showed doctors smoking Camels, but in others, physicians preferred Lucky Strikes. So there was some disagreement. Indeed, eminent doctors on high and impartial medical authority call for Philip Morris. That is a quote straight out of an ad. Let's hear that quote again. Quote, "Eminent doctors on high and impartial medical authority call for Philip Morris," end quote. Even leading nose and throat specialists couldn't agree which cigarette is better for your throat. Probably best to stick to the science, and touts another ad, quote, "More scientists smoke Kent," end quote. This should not be rocket science, but even the rocket scientists had their favorite viceroys for the, quote, "man who thinks for himself," end quote. Why am I putting all those quotes and end quotes in there? Because I want you to hear this is all stuff that was being fed to the public through their eyes, their ears, there any way they could get information into your head. They were telling you, look, if you think for yourself, you're going to have viceroys. If you're a scientist, you're going to smoke Kent. And if you're a doctor, you want to call on Philip Morris. Oh my goodness. Listen to this. This is unbelievable. Can you guess then why the American Medical Association, also called the AMA, quote, went on record as withholding endorsement of the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health? They went on record withholding the endorsement on the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health, which documented the important role of cigarettes in lung cancer. A gift from the tobacco companies of $10 million may have had a little something to do with that. But why weren't more individual doctors speaking out? Well, there were a few gallant souls ahead of their time, writing into medical journals as there are today, standing up against industries killing millions. But why not more? Well, maybe it's because the majority of physicians themselves smoked cigarettes. Just like, here we go, the majority of physicians today continue to eat foods that contribute to our epidemics of dietary diseases. What was the AMA's rallying cry way back then? Everything in moderation. The AMA said extensive scientific studies have proved that smoking in moderation is okay. Wow. Isn't that interesting? I love that. Eating the standard American diet today is like being a smoker in the 1950s. Just as smoking was rampant back then, think about what we're feeding even hospital patients to this day. Sidebar, here we go. Look up a guy named Chris Wark, W-A-R-K, Chris Wark. And he has a whole website. I think it's called ChrisBeatCancer.com, I think is the name of his website. He's phenomenal. This guy was like 26 or 27. He wasn't feeling very good. He goes to the doctor and they're like, "Oh, we're so sorry, Mr. Super Young Man, 26, 27. You have stage 4 colon cancer." What? The guy was totally freaked out. He's like, "What do you mean I have stage 4 colon cancer?" "Yeah, you do, blah, blah, blah." So I'm not going to tell you his whole heinous story, which is really super heinous. But after removing a section of his colon, they brought him a sloppy Joe. That's what they served him in the hospital, a sloppy Joe. His story is pretty amazing. So if you want to read about how Chris beat cancer, and I think it's been 15 or 16 years since then. So he's gone on to get married and have some beautiful children. And, you know, he eats an incredibly vibrant, life-promoting diet now. And you'd probably be interested. So Chris beats cancer. You can find him on the internet. Look, we don't have to wait until society catches up with the science. Sometimes it takes a whole generation for things to change in medicine. The old guard of smoking physicians and medical school professors die off, and a new generation takes its place. But how many people need to die in the interim? Wow. Dr. Greger says, I try to answer the question that arises in the minds of pretty much anyone dipping even a single toe into the lifestyle medicine literature. You know, he says, look, people are saying all the time, wait a second, if this were true, why didn't my doctor tell me? So if, for example, our number one killer can be reversed through diet, why isn't it front page news and taught to every medical student, broadcast from every mountaintop by medical organizations, and featured in our government dietary guidelines? Are you still confused? Well, check out other videos that address these questions. There's a bunch of them. And so I'm going to go into some of those right now. But just so you know, Dr. Greger says, for more parallels on smoking then and eating today, see these other videos. So I'm going to go into those videos. If you're interested and you want to go do a little research on your own, visit nutritionfacts.org. And we're looking at an article today called How Could There Be Such a Disconnect Between the Science and Medical Practice? You know, the crazy thing is, as Dr. Greger just said, the old school physicians who smoked and the medical professors who were smoking in classrooms. I mean, we can't even imagine, right, that you used to be able to smoke in classrooms, smoke in hospitals, smoke in doctor's offices, smoke on airplanes, smoke in restaurants. I remember in the early 80s, this is kind of a cool story. No, I'm just going to tell it. In the early 80s, Gary and I, we won a trip to the East Coast. And we woke up late. You know, it was in the days before 9/11, security was pretty lax at airports. But we woke up, we were an hour away from the airport. And we woke up with just a couple minutes to spare, hadn't set our alarm right or something. So we leaped out of bed. We're super young then. I don't know, 21, 20 something, real super young. We raced to LAX. Park the car, grab our stuff, fly in as fast as we can and get in line. Just as the flight attendant, they were called stewardesses back then, comes down the line and there's all these other people that had won this trip and they were all colleagues of mine. So we all knew each other. And they come in and they're like, oh, we need two volunteers. And everybody figured we were going to be sent to the back of the plane in the smoking section. Every place was a smoking section back then. And I can remember having to like lay down across Gary's lap in the plane to get below the smoke level. And everybody sort of went, oh, well, why don't you take them? And they kind of pointed to us. You know, here we were harried, just rushed in. You know, I don't even think we took a shower. Like we got out of bed, brushed our hair, brushed our teeth, jumped in the car and drove. This is the best part ever. This is such a great story. So they go, okay, well, yeah, take those people. So Gary and I get led by the stewardess onto the aircraft, and it was a 747, but not only did we go forward, we went upstairs. That's right. So all those other people that figured we were going to be in the smoking den found us upstairs with a grand piano and filet mignon and champagne. It was really pretty cool. All those things that could lead to death, destruction, and heart disease today were all the things that were on the aircraft back then, the filet mignon, the champagne, and the cigarettes. And now, you know, we take it for granted, don't we, that you can't smoke at the library. You can't smoke in the doctor's office. You don't usually have smoking in restaurants even anymore. I don't know if you smoke in bars because I don't go to bars, but I think even in bars, you got to go outside. You don't smoke in these places. You don't smoke on aircraft. But at one point, if you would have suggested to people, hey, you're not going to be able to smoke outside. You're not going to, you have to walk 25 feet away from a door. People would laugh at you for that kind of thing. They'd be like, are you kidding? Come on. That's crazy. The way things change, right? Well, back in the day, even the paleo folks were smoking, and so were the doctors. And there was, of course, controversy within the doctors, that whether or not you should be smoking Viceroy's or Kent. And I want you to go back and read this stuff. I want you to go back to nutritionfacts.org. We're going to talk a little bit about a video that Dr. Greger did American Medical Association complicity with Big Tobacco. What do you think about that? Do you think there's complicity there? Do you think there's a wink and a nod and a handshake? I don't know, that $10 million way back when that helped keep the Surgeon General's report from being put out there. I mean, you would laugh today, wouldn't you, if there were no warning labels on cigarettes? Of course there's a warning label on cigarettes. Of course there is. Of course there's a warning label on alcohol saying if pregnant ladies drink this, their baby's going to be up, right? Of course there's a warning label. Would there ever maybe be a warning label on bacon? Could it be bacon? Did you know that bacon is completely tied to anal cancer? Yeah, bacon and anal cancer. They go in the same sentence. I know that sounds gross and nobody has anal cancer. I get that. That's what Farrah Fawcett died of. Beautiful woman. I don't know if she ate a lot of bacon. I don't know what her diet was about. I loved her in the 70s and 80s. I thought she was amazing. And, you know, bacon and highly processed meats are actually a class one carcinogen, ranked right up there with tobacco and plutonium. But why is there no Surgeon General's warning on those products? Is there complicity? Well, listen to this. Back in 1912, when hardly anyone smoked cigarettes, lung cancer was like a museum curiosity. It was extremely rare. But in the next few decades, it rose dramatically around the world, around 15-fold. But they had already nailed it back in 1912. By mid-century, the evidence was considered overwhelming, says who? Says the tobacco industry's own research scientists in an internal memo. We now know that senior scientists and executives within the cigarette industry knew about the cancer risks of smoking at least as early as the 1940s. But publicly, they said things like this: oh, sure, there are statistics associating lung cancer and cigarettes. There are statistics associating lung cancer with all sorts of things, but there's no proof. Well, what was the government saying? Smoke luckies. I mean, who wouldn't want to give their throat a vacation? Not a single case of throat irritation. How could your nose and throat be adversely affected? Cigarettes are just as pure as the water you drink. And if you do get irritated, no problem. Your doctor can write you a prescription for cigarettes. This is an ad from the Journal of the American Medical Association. After all, don't smoke is hard advice for patients to swallow. Reminds me of the recent survey of doctors that found the number one reason doctors don't prescribe heart-healthy diets was their perception that patients fear being deprived of all the junk they're eating. After all, Philip Morris reminds us, we want to keep our patients happy. To make a radical change in habit may do harm. You're a doctor. You don't want to harm your patients. Even bunnies prefer Philip Morris when you instill smoke solutions in their eyes. I know all this sounds crazy, right? It's like, oh my God, is she ranting? Yes, I'm ranting. Is it real? Yes, it's real. Is this historical, factual information? Yes, it is. You don't have to go too far to find it. In this particular video that we're looking at, this is in nutritionfacts.org, American Medical Association complicity, Big Tobacco. Go type that into the web and look at this video. Watch the video. You can look at the charts. You can see the ads yourself. You don't have to like hear it and think that I'm ranting and then nothing's true here. It's true. You can go back and see it. If you want to get real nerdy, you can go down to the library and pick up some microfiche and look at some old magazines and look at the tobacco ads. I remember seeing tobacco ads as a kid. I remember seeing tobacco ads on TV and then even in magazines everywhere. It was everywhere. This is what Dr. Greger says. The tobacco industry gave medical journals big bucks to run ads like these. Not a problem, though. Philip Morris, I don't know if you know, but Philip Morris is one of the largest tobacco manufacturers, and then American Brands is another, but those two are two of the biggies. Philip Morris claims come from completely reliable sources based on studies conducted by recognized authorities published in leading medical journals, even kindly offering to send free packs of cigarettes to doctors so they can test them out themselves. So join us at the next AMA convention, right? Like you could go to an American Medical Association convention and stop by the Philip Morris booth. What do we know about today? Well, let's see. What did the American Medical Association have to say for itself? Well, like most other medical journals, they accepted tobacco ads, and we have yet to see an autopsy with a single lesion that had a Marlboro label on it. No lung tumor has ever been found with a little tag attached that said, made in the tobacco fields of North Carolina, case closed. Ha ha. In fact, even after the Surgeon General's report came out, the American Medical Association, the American Cancer Society, and Congress were still dragging their feet. The government was still subsidizing tobacco, like our tax dollars subsidize the sugar and meat industries today. Boy, that pisses me off. The AMA actually went on record withholding endorsement of the Surgeon General's report. Could that have been because they were just handed $10 million from the tobacco industry? Well, go figure. Today, the money is coming from big food. The American Academy of Family Physicians has accepted large sums of money from Coca-Cola to fund patient education on obesity prevention. Boy, I wonder what that pamphlet's going to say. Who was the number one partner listed on Coca-Cola's website? The American College of Cardiology. Is that not insane? Just as it would have been hazardous to your health to take the medical profession's advice on your smoking habits in the 1950s, it may be hazardous to your health today to take the medical profession's advice on your eating habits. Wow. It is like you look at that and you think that can't be true. That Coca-Cola is not supported by, or the American College of Cardiology is not supported by Coca-Cola. But in fact, it's the way it goes. It's pretty amazing. What about big food now, today, using the tobacco industry playbook? Well, you think that's true? Well, listen to this. In 1954, again, from Dr. Greger's nutritionfacts.org website, which is phenomenal, all evidence-based nutrition. I mean, this guy digs into everything. If you have a skin issue, go type it in. If you have a gut issue, go type it in. If you have a brain issue, a joint issue, you know, some kind of weird bump, type it into nutritionfacts.org because, you know, you've heard, let thy medicine be thy food and thy food be thy medicine. Wow. You know, it's really true. And you've heard me say every bite of food you take is either fighting disease or feeding disease. It's either promoting wellness or promoting illness. You get to decide. I love that part. Hey, thanks for joining me on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. Thanks for being part of our discussion here on, you know, nutrition topics. We're here in Brookings Harbor, Oregon on KCIW 100.7 FM on your radio dial or anywhere in the world, any time of day on the podcast. I'd like to say hello to Mafon again. I know I always talk about Mafon because yesterday I told Mafon in Africa, I said, hey, sometimes I talk about you. And I just say, I've got a great friend named Mafon and she's in Africa and she's pretty amazing. And maybe next year she's going to come out here to Brookings Harbor to say hello. And I hope, Mafon, I hope you will wear some of your amazing African gear. It's so beautiful. So check this out. In 1954, the tobacco industry paid to publish the Frank Statement to Cigarette Smokers in hundreds of U.S. newspapers. It stated that the public's health was the industry's concern above all else, and it promised a variety of good faith changes. The Frank Statement was a charade, the first step in a concerted half-century-long campaign to mislead Americans about the catastrophic effects of smoking and to avoid public policy that might damage sales. What followed were decades of deceit and actions that cost millions of lives. In the hope that the food industry history will be written differently, these researchers highlight important lessons that can be learned from the tobacco experience. The processed food industries use tactics similar to those used by tobacco companies to undermine public health interventions. They do this by distorting research findings, co-opting policymakers and health professionals, and lobbying politicians and public officials. In his book about his fight with the tobacco industry, former FDA Commissioner David Kessler recounted similar strong-arm tactics used by the meat industry to try to squash nutrition regulations. The Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, allowing corporations to spend unlimited amounts on political ads during election campaigns, could make things even worse by working against candidates who support public health positions. Another similarity between tobacco and food companies is the introduction and heavy marketing of safer or healthier products. When cigarette sales dropped due to health concerns, the industry introduced safer filtered cigarettes that gave health-conscious smokers an alternative to quitting, and sales shot right back up. Ironically, the filters originally had asbestos in them. Oh boy! Less nicotine, less tar, and now with reduced carcinogens. And how could anything be bad for you if it's 100% organic? Today, leaner pork or eggs with less cholesterol may be the food industry's low-tar cigarettes. A KFC ad campaign depicted an African-American family in which the father was told by the mother that KFC has 0 grams of trans fat now. The father, in the presence of the children, shouts, "Yeah, baby, woohoo!" and then begins eating the fried chicken by the bucketful. Or cereal companies touting all the whole grains in their Cocoa Puffs Brownie Crunch. Fruit Loops now provides fiber. Wow. I can't make this stuff up, you guys. And I hope you can hear the absolute, you know, disdain and just amazement and amusement in my voice. Oh my goodness. A U.S. district judge overseeing a tobacco industry case put it well. He said, quote, "All too often in the choice between the physical health of consumers and the financial well-being of business, concealment is chosen over disclosure, sales over safety, and money over morality. Who are these persons who knowingly and secretly decide to put the buying public at risk solely for the purpose of making profits and who believe that illness and death of consumers is an apparent cost of their own prosperity," end quote. That is a quote from a judge. It is so powerful, I am going to read it again. The judge said, "All too often in the choice between the physical health of consumers and the financial well-being of business, concealment is chosen over disclosure, sales over safety, and money over morality. Who are these persons who knowingly and secretly decide to put the buying public at risk solely for the purpose of making profits and who believe that illness and death of consumers is an apparent cost of their own prosperity?" A judge asked that question. Above all, the experience of tobacco shows how powerful profits can be as a motivator, even at the cost of millions of lives and unspeakable suffering. Now look, remember, you're going to go check out this video. You're going to go to nutritionfacts.org. You're going to look at Big Food Using the Tobacco Industry Playbook. Because why? You want to see the charts, the graphs, and you want to see the actual video. And this is just crazy. We're going to talk now about collaboration with the new vectors of disease. Before I go right on to that, just a couple of days ago, I have discovered a new source of information. I'm super excited. I'll be sharing some information with you soon from an organization called The Conversation, which you can find at theconversation.com. These guys are amazing, nonpartisan, scientific, you know, just public health, safety, economy, industry, all kinds of topics, education. I mean, you name it, they're talking about it at The Conversation, and they've given me permission to share their stories with you. So I'm going to have a whole series coming up that's probably not going to be nutrition related, although it's hard for me to come in the studio and not talk about nutrition. Go to The Conversation, find information from them, and go to nutritionfacts.org and look up this video, Collaboration with the New Vectors of Disease. So Dr. Greger says, when the history of the world's attempt to address obesity is written, oh, I forgot, I was going to tell you something. So let me just go back for a second. I read the other day that China and India now have, just by the numbers of people, so not percentage of the population, but per capita, the actual number of people, they have more obese, morbidly obese, and overweight people in China and India now than in America, which is amazing because we kind of lead the country or lead the world on these things. But this is the part that blew my mind. Even though the standard American diet is now becoming the global industrial diet, right? So we've gone from sad to giddy. So now we've got the global industrial diet. Everybody's adopting this diet because they see America as the land of opportunity, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And, you know, we have everything, we get everything, we be everything, we eat everything. And the rest of the world wants to follow suit. Check this out. Over the next 3 years, a new McDonald's will open every single day in China. Every single day. That's how many are going to be open. So that means, you know, there might be 5 that open one day and then a period of 5 days where one doesn't open. But the average number of new McDonald's for the next 3 years in China is 1 per day. Is that crazy? We want to kill people off. There's a great way to do it. Just feed them the standard American diet. They'll be giddy in no time. So when the history of the world's attempt to address obesity is actually written, the greatest failure may be collaboration with and appeasement of the food industry. For instance, Yum Brands, who owns Kentucky Fried Chicken, linked up with a leading U.S. breast cancer charity to sell pink buckets of fried chicken. Oh my goodness. Save the Children, an organization aimed to positively change the lives of children, was initially a staunch supporter of soda taxes, but recently the organization withdrew its support, saying that support of the soda taxes did not fit the way Save the Children works. Perhaps it's only a coincidence that it was seeking a grant from Coca-Cola and had accepted a $5 million grant from Pepsi. That's interesting. Through these partnerships, the food industry seeks to emphasize that inactivity, not the promotion and consumption of its calorie-rich products, is the prime cause of obesity. So inactivity, yeah, we can all agree kids are hanging out on their phones and video games too much, for sure. But now organizations like Save the Children are saying, oh, it's not the soda, it's something else. Studies like this, though, showing that obesity is rising even in areas where people are exercising more, are most likely explained by the fact that the rate of physical activity levels are being outstripped by our eating activity levels. The message is plain, Dr. Greger says. The primary driver of the obesity epidemic in the United States is now the food supply, and interventions targeting physical activity are not going to resolve it. So, while physical activity is good regardless, it will not address most of the burden of ill health caused by obesity. That's going to require a new focus on the root cause of the problem, which is the American diet. You know, it's crazy. You can go to the bank on Friday morning to take care of your business, and there's popcorn right there for free in the bank. And there's coffee, which I love my coffee. I do. I don't put all the heavy duty cream or sugar, blah, blah, blah in it, but there's popcorn and coffee at the bank. Then you can run across the street to the hardware store. Oh, there's more popcorn and it's free too. That's awesome. You can get your light bulbs and your little, you know, nuts and bolts that you need. And on the way out, there are massive opportunities to buy candy, peanut butter, brittle snacks, you know, chocolates, nuts that are caked in sugar. I mean, really, food is rampant. It's everywhere. You cannot go anywhere without getting bombarded by food. So you leave the hardware store and you go to get your hair cut, and there's a little dish of free candy for you. Isn't that nice of them? And then when you swing by the market to, are you going to buy some lettuce and potatoes and tomatoes and healthy stuff? Or are you going to go in the market and buy red, green, blue, and yellow packaging? And while you're there, are you going to get some, you know, it's Mother's Day weekend, so they're going to be sampling some chocolate-covered strawberries for you or something. I mean, it's just crazy. I don't shop at Costco. And part of the reason I don't is just because you go in there and you want one thing, and $400 later, you come out with a car full of stuff you don't need. And I know I'm not alone on this. I know you know what I'm talking about. But the other part is you can't go in there without getting assaulted with, you know, try this deep fried such and such and that bread covered AYZ and this other, you know, fish fillet with cheese and ranch dressing junk. I mean, it's crazy. Food is everywhere. So, I mean, if it's going to require a new focus on the root cause of the problem, which is the American diet, we have to also look at the heart of the energy in side of the obesity problem. That's the heart of it. It's the energy inside of the obesity problem, and it's the food and beverage industry. So put simply, Dr. Greger says, the enormous commercial success enjoyed by the food industry is now causing what promises to be one of the greatest public health disasters of our time. As fast as we rid the world of the microbial causes of pestilence and famine, they are now replaced by new vectors of disease in the form of transnational food corporations that market salt, fat, sugar, and calories in unprecedented quantities. So policymakers should work on pricing strategies that subsidize the cost of healthier foods. Wow. First, we need to shift relative prices to make it more expensive to consume animal products compared with fruit, veggies, and beans. And second, we need to increase demand for plant foods, which is not as easy given the hundreds of billions of dollars in annual subsidies that our taxpayer dollars are going to make animal products artificially cheap. You know, that always just bugs me. That just bugs me. You know, we're paying on both ends of this transaction, people. You're a taxpayer. I'm a taxpayer. We're paying on both ends of this transaction. We're subsidizing the animal industry. We're causing suffering among all these animals and the farm workers that are having to kill these animals on a day-to-day basis. They suffer high rates of disease and distress and mental illness and all of that kind of stuff. And then we've already paid for the animal heinousness at the beginning. Then we eat the animals, or some people eat the animals, and then they pay on the back end with heart disease, cancer, diabetes, dementia, you know, you name it, all of these problems that are coming from eating animals. Wow. Hundreds of billions of dollars in annual subsidies. Wow. You know what? The food industry will rail against the nanny state and will fight tooth and nail for its right to market a range of options to responsible individuals to make choices for themselves, because that's the American way. Shoot, you know, come on, that's the American way. They're going to fight tooth and nail. For context, though, these arguments are no different to those used by the tobacco industry, which also markets habituating unhealthy products in pursuit of profit. It reminds me of what that judge said before. He said, who are these people that put, you know, profits over people? It's crazy. In the case of tobacco, the American people have agreed that controls must be applied to limit the harms caused. Poor diet is now responsible for an even greater burden of disease than tobacco, and food companies must be controlled in the same way if the harms are to be reduced. As unpalatable as this may be, the food industry would do well to strengthen their public health conscience, given that consumers are always going to need their goods, something that cannot be said for the tobacco industry. You'll hear that a lot in public health circles, how we have to work with the companies because, unlike tobacco, we have to eat. But just like, yes, we need to breathe, we don't need to breathe smoke. Yes, we do need to eat, but we don't need to eat junk. You know, you guys can all remember the old computer adage from so long ago, garbage in, garbage out. What do you think? You know, garbage in, garbage out. The same is true. If we're putting junk in our bodies, aren't we going to get junk out of it? Would you think that cancer is junk? I do. Heart disease, junk? Yep. Dementia, junk? Yep. Where does that plaque come from in the brain? Well, there's a whole lot of people out there right now, medical professionals, evidence-based, saying that plaque in the brain is the same plaque that's in the heart. They're saying that kids have plaque in their heart. The first evidence of heart disease is now showing up in kids as young as 10 years old. You've heard me say that before. That's nothing new. But that brain stuff, where's that plaque coming from? I don't know. Animal products? That's what the evidence is saying. So what about when low risk means high risk? Well, how else can we make decisions for ourselves and our families? But by the best available balance of evidence, right? Because that's what we're here for. We're here for the evidence. We're not here for opinion. We're not here for, well, I think she said or he said or it might be or my theory is. No, we're just looking at the evidence. Remember, Dr. Greger looks at every medical journal, English language article published every year, and he reports the best ones for us. And then he gives me and you and everyone a Creative Commons license to just rampantly repeat his information, which I'm glad to do on your behalf. Right here on KCIW, on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. This is Curry Coast Community Radio, and we're based right here in Brookings Harbor, Oregon. Or if you're on the podcast, anywhere in the world, doesn't matter. All right, so what about this? How else can we make decisions for ourselves and our family, but by the best available balance of evidence? The latest meta-analysis, pooling data from more than a dozen studies involving more than 300,000 people, indicates that there's a dose-dependent association between egg consumption and the risk of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. But that doesn't mean every single individual study showed evidence of harm. So even though the totality of evidence points to harm, the egg industry can certainly cherry-pick out studies that show no apparent effects. So if eggs are harmful, though, why don't all studies on heart disease and egg consumption show significant harm? Well, it may have to do with Rose's concept of a sick population. If an entire population is sick, then the range of health may not be sufficiently broad to establish a significant association. Let me explain. This is one of the most famous papers ever written in preventive medicine. It should be required reading for all medical students. So ready? Imagine if everyone smoked 20 cigarettes a day. If everybody smoked, then clinical studies or case control studies, cohort studies, would all lead us to conclude that lung cancer was a genetic disease. And in one sense, that would be true. Interesting, right? Because some smokers get cancer, other smokers smoke their whole lives and don't. But if everybody smoked, we would never know that smoking was a risk factor. Oh, that is so fascinating. So this is called Rose's, like a woman's name or a flower, Rose's concept of a sick population. That's very interesting. But thankfully, in the case of cigarettes and lung cancer, it just so happened that the original study populations contained about equal numbers of smokers and non-smokers. And in that situation, Studies are able to identify the main risk factors, but comparatively, let's take cholesterol. Here's the cholesterol levels of the people without heart disease in the famous Framingham Heart Study. Now remember, I'm looking at information from a video, and if you want to see the actual chart, you're going to go to nutritionfacts.org, and you're going to look for the video when low risk means high risk. Easy. So here's the cholesterol levels of people of those that did develop heart disease. It's hardly any different because practically everybody's cholesterol was too high. It's like everyone was a smoker, in other words. The painful truth is that even someone at low risk for heart disease is likely to die of heart disease because everyone who eats the standard American diet, in fact, is a high-risk individual when it comes to heart disease. And you know what's crazy? Heart disease is completely reversible. It's preventable, first of all, and reversible. Now, does that mean that every single person who eats a vegan lifestyle for the rest of the world, of all humanity, that no vegan will ever get heart disease? That's probably not true. Probably there are vegans out there, or plant-based, whole food plant-based people who have heart disease. Who knows? I'd be really curious if there's ever been a population of 100% whole food plant-based people. You know, does that even exist in the world anymore? Someone who never, ever, ever had an animal product? And then have they been able to collect enough of those people to do a long-term study? I don't know. That'd be really interesting. I should ask Dr. Greger about that. But in a sick population like ours, where nearly everyone is eating lots of saturated fat and cholesterol, adding some more saturated fat and cholesterol in the form of eggs may just take us from one sorry state, probably dying from heart disease, to another sorry state, still probably dying from heart disease. So when the federal guidelines say we need to really restrict dietary cholesterol, especially if we're at high risk for heart disease, we need to realize that nearly all Americans that live past middle age are at high risk of dying from heart disease. Got to remember, it's our number one cause of death. That little thing that's in there ticking away right now while you're listening, tick, 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 it's in there, possibly heart diseased out already. You can reverse it though. Go get the book Undo It by Dr. What's the doc's name? I can't remember all of a sudden. I can see his face as plain as day in my head. Let's see. He's the longtime Dr. Dean Ornish. That's who it is. So we're quoting here, a 20-year-old man might feel that it's safe to smoke and eat egg yolks because his heart attack is 45 or so years in the future. But why would he want to accelerate the progression of the atherosclerotic plaque to bring it on sooner? Stopping egg yolks after the heart attack would be like quitting smoking after lung cancer is diagnosed. That's kind of crazy, right? There may, in fact, be a plateau of risk for smoking too. Whether we smoke for 25 years or 35 years, our risk of lung cancer may be about the same, really high, but about the same. So the tobacco industry could truthfully tell someone who smoked for most of their lives for the last 25 years, keep smoking. Don't worry, you can keep smoking and your risk of lung cancer won't go up. Conveniently, just failing to mention that you're already really at high risk, and if you quit completely, your risk would drop dramatically. Interesting, right? So in the same way, the egg industry can design a study showing that adding eggs doesn't make much of a difference, but make the same convenient omission. Imagine if you took a raging drunk and had them take a shot of whiskey. In someone who's hammered, it might not make much of a difference, but to a teetotaler, a couple shots could have quite an effect. So it's like the alcohol industry with a group of drunks saying, see, a couple shots, no big deal. But that doesn't mean it's not better to be sober. Instead of going high risk to high risk, it's better to go low risk or no risk. Oh my gosh, this stuff is just crazy. You know, when I read these things, when I learn about these things, when I hear about strategies that we can take, I'm heartened by this. It gives me a sense of personal energy, of responsibility, of opportunity. Yeah, I get on here and rant. Why? Because each of us gets the choice. You've heard me say it so many times. I'm never going to stop saying it. It's our choice. Every bite of food is either fighting disease or feeding disease. It's either supporting wellness or supporting illness. Wellness or illness? I mean, I think most of us would choose wellness, but there's so much confusion still in the marketplace. And my goal when we're talking about nutrition is to help thwart confusion, because this I know for sure, this is a writer downer. It's four words and it's a big statement. Confused people do nothing. So if you've been listening in on the Ocean Mist Power Hour on KCIW for a few times, or maybe this is your first time, maybe you're confused. Don't be confused. Get the information, because if you're confused, you're not going to do anything. But if you know and you understand what's happening when you put food into your mouth, once you know, you can't unknow. And once you're no longer confused, you will not be able to do nothing. You won't be able to do nothing. You'll feel incensed, outraged that you've been lied to and cheated of your own health and wellness. That is your birthright. Your body is designed to be healthy. It's designed for a process called homeostasis, which essentially means that your body, when something's gone awry, your body goes, kicks into high gear, sends out the fighters, and brings it back into balance. But it can't bring it back into balance when every single meal is filled with artery-clogging, brain-wrecking, heart disease-creating foods that we're being told aren't so bad for us, right? So it's, and I know I'm making all these comparisons with the tobacco industry, because so many of us, especially if we're right here in Brookings Harbor, you're in my age group, you're in my category, we were all told cigarette smoking's fine. There's no problem. The doctor smokes. He likes Kent's better, right? We all heard that. Well, it was a bunch of horse manure. It was. Check this out. There's strength in unity. Dr. Greger, the healthy food movement, strength in unity, he says the tobacco industry has focused more recently on a divide and conquer strategy to create schisms within the tobacco control movement. Well, in the healthy food community, we can learn from this by staying united and not allowing minor disagreements to distract us from the bigger picture. Dietary changes appear to be shifting universally toward a diet dominated by higher intakes of calorie-dense foods, corn syrup, sugar, animal products, and oils, thanks to global agricultural policies that have built in a long-term focus on creating things like cheap corn. Consumption of these foods high in saturated and trans fats, salt, and sugar is the cause of at least 14 million deaths every year. And how many of us just feel that ripoff? You know, someone you know and love who died too young, you know, cancer or heart disease or some other heinous diabetic condition, that maybe they lost an arm or a leg or their vision to something like that. This is not a failure of individual willpower, says the Director General of the World Health Organization. This is a failure of political will to take on big business, which is a formidable opposition. Few governments prioritize health over big business. And as we learn from experience with the tobacco industry, a powerful corporation can sell the public just about anything. This is difficult terrain for many public health scientists. It took 5 decades after the initial studies linking tobacco and cancer for effective public health policies to be put in place, with enormous cost to human health. Must we wait another 5 decades to respond to the epidemics of dietary diseases? They do have money on their side. The chemical, tobacco, and food industries have the luxury to share similar tactics with the drug companies because they have the resources to do so. By contrast, powerful and cheap health-promoting activities like eating a healthy diet are too cheap and can't be patented. Like, you know, who holds the patent on broccoli? Preventing cardiovascular disease is not an easy task because it means engaging in a battle against strong industrial sectors. But it is possible with sufficient political courage, and it has been done before. There's a great example of action in public health nutrition that is succeeding. The move back to breastfeeding, for example. Breast milk doesn't make anyone any money. So companies like Nestle pushed infant formulas and millions of babies may have died as a result. But a global movement rose up and resulted in the passage of a code regulating the marketing of breast milk substitutes. And as the Director General of the World Health Organization at the time said, without their constant lobbying, reminding us of our duty as public health officers, they simply would not have had the courage to do it. What has this got to do with food and nutrition policy now? Everything. Everything. If we want to improve public health, we must seek out the food and nutrition equivalents of Greenpeace. We should be prepared to stand up and be counted, even if it puts jobs and careers in nutrition on the line. To do that, the healthy food movement needs to stay united. Philip Morris is still fighting into the 21st century. Check out their latest campaign dubbed Project Sunrise, which they hope will lead to the dawn of a new day for the company. An explicit divide-and-conquer strategy against the tobacco control movement. This is from the actual internal planning documents. They figured out that the number one vulnerability of the anti-smoking movement is that their success may blind organizations to carefully orchestrated efforts by the tobacco industry and its allies to accelerate turf wars and exacerbate philosophical schisms. Their overall objective is to attack the credibility of the anti-smoking movement by creating schisms to force them to fight amongst themselves. Think of how much of that we already do in the healthy food movement, distracting us from the bigger picture. Because unity was identified as a source of strength for the anti-smoking movement, one of their primary strategies is to drive a wedge between various anti-smoking groups, and another is to weaken the public health movement's credibility. One strategy to weaken the credibility of anti-tobacco groups is to develop communication strategies to demonstrate the extremism of the health prevention movement. First tobacco, then alcohol, then meat, then who knows? Not only are tobacco lawyers a bit spelling challenged, but public health groups are part of a health promotion movement. Health prevention is more the purview of big agriculture. Now, the spelling thing is a reference to a graph that is in this video. So again, if you want to see any of this material, you're going to go to nutritionfacts.org. The video we just overviewed was called The Healthy Food Movement, Strength in Unity. Here's what I know for sure. You can't go wrong eating stuff that comes right out of the earth, really. I mean, yeah, you could eat some Jimson weed or something that's going to make you sick. Sure, there's some things that come out of the earth that, you know, are poisonous. Hemlock can take you down, right? There's a few things. But fruits and vegetables, not going to hurt you. You know, have you ever heard of anybody dying of a lack of protein? Because that's the one thing as a whole food plant-based person I hear, well, where do you get your protein? I get it from broccoli, cauliflower, lettuce, oranges, apples, bananas, grapes. You know, I eat lots and lots of fruits and veggies, and you can too. And you know, again, it's up to you. Your food in your fork and your finger going to your face, your hands, you're the one that chooses every single bite of food that goes into your mouth. You can make a better choice, and I encourage you to do that. Your nutrition, it is personal. It's really personal. Make it worth it for you too. Thanks for joining me today on the Ocean Mist Power Hour. I'm so glad to have you along for this crazy, wild, frenetic ride that we call the nutrition nerd thing, you know? I'm glad you were here today. I hope you'll join me again in the future. And thanks again. I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
The opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program. The information provided is not intended to substitute for professional medical advice. Always seek the advice of your personal physician or other qualified healthcare professional before changing your healthcare treatment, diet, or lifestyle.